KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Avalanche on Red Mountain near the Alpental ski area. She was a naturopathic physician who practiced in Bellevue. Wind turbines have been springing up across the Pacific Northwest over the past decade, but not this year. EarthFix reporter Courtney Flatt says this year, it's a different story.
This year, there are no new wind farms under construction in the Pacific Northwest. Compare that to last year's boom, which increased wind capacity in the region by about 20%. That's according to an update on wind energy by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. Jillian Charles is an energy policy analyst with the council.
More wind will be developed, just may not be at the speed that it was in the past 10 years. You know, we've gone kind of from 0 to 100 pretty quickly here.
Charles says there were a couple of big reasons for the halt in wind farm construction. The first, uncertainty about whether Congress would renew a tax credit for wind energy producers last year. The other reason is that the amount of power people used last year went down. Right now, up to 90% of the region's renewable energy is generated by wind farms. I'm Courtney Flatt, reporting.
Called Barefoot Bandit is due back in court in Mount Vernon today. He is expected to plead guilty to a Skagit County burglary charge. In a plea deal with County Prosecutor Rich Weirich, the 22-year-old is pleading guilty for breaking into the Anacortes Airport in 2010, where he stole a plane to flew it to Orcas Island. Weirich agreed to a 3-month time-served sentence for Colton Harris Moore, which will not add to his 7-year prison term. I'm Lisa Brooks, KUOW News.
54 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 71 this afternoon, and these morning clouds should go away and leave us with lots of sun. Support for NPR comes from Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at Wix.com. It's 10:06.
Little swagger there from KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher is on sabbatical till October. British Columbia holds an election next week. Last week, it looked like a cakewalk for the new Democrats. This week, well, not so much. Our Canadian correspondent Vaughn Palmer is here with the latest. Hello, Vaughn.
Hi, Marcy.
So last week, you were telling me new Democrats by a mile, and the race has tightened a bit, yes?
Yeah, this does tend to happen in British Columbia elections. People tell the pollsters one thing well before the election, and then as voting day approaches, things tighten up. Our elections tend to be close. The last two elections in BC were decided by 4 points, separating them in the popular vote. So that's pretty close. What's happened here is that the New Democrats, the opposition party in BC, has been pushing time for a change. They've been ahead by a country mile, or country kilometer, as we say here.
Country
Canada.
Kilometer, yes.
And, 20 points in one poll, 19, 17. Last Friday, however, we got the polls out, and the lead has been chopped in half. One poll has them just 7 points ahead. Another one has them 10 points ahead. You still win at that level, but I guess we're waiting now for the polls to come out at the end of this week. If the lead is chopped again, we may have some momentum happening for the government and might change the odds of an outcome.
What do you attribute this change? Is it just that people are a little bit leery about making a political change?
I think that's a big part of it. Change is scary for a lot of people, and especially, you know, for entrenched interests, if you feel that the economy is doing pretty well, if you've got a comfortable job, if you're children are in university and they're doing well. I mean, all the things that lead to a status quo point of view, I think people start focusing on that. The other thing I think that happens, and this may be a little more comparable to the situation in some jurisdictions in the United States, our elections do tend to come down to a choice between two main parties. You've got the ins and the outs, or you've got the party of the center right and the party of the center left. And the province tends to polarize around that choice. So as election day approaches, even if you've got a lot of reservations about your party and its platform and its record, in this case the Liberals have been in power for 12 years, they've got lots of baggage, I think you're seeing some people coming back to the party brand and saying, oh, well, they're better than the other guys. So I think those two things are happening. Having said all that, I'll still be surprised if we don't get a change of government. I just think after 12 years, there is a feeling with the public that it is time to give the other side a chance, see how they do. It is time to send the government to the opposition side to reflect on the errors of their ways and maybe let the other bunch come in and work on the error of their ways. So, as I said, I'll be really surprised if this thing doesn't lead to a change of government. But you do have to acknowledge now that it's not over till it's over, as they say in the sporting world.
Well, it's interesting because I know that how your elections work a little differently than ours. They're more parliamentarian. Whoever wins the majority of seats gets to put the leader in place. So what is the X factor of Christy Clark versus the New Democratic Party's leader, Adrian Dix, have to do with how people think about what's going on?
Yeah, it's unusual. You're quite right. The big difference is, you know, you go in and vote in one of our elections, you get one ballot, you're electing only one office, so it's not like an American election where you're voting for a senator and a congressional representative and a president and a governor sometimes and state representatives and state senate and dog catcher and a whole bunch of other things.
Right.
You get one ballot, and all you're voting for, what your ballot will have on it, is the local candidate for the party, their name, and the party identification. So if you're supporting Christy Clark and the BC Liberals, you will see who the BC Liberal candidate is in your constituency. There's 85 of those. And you're right. If Clark's party wins a majority of those constituencies, she gets to be premier. There's only one place in British Columbia where Christy Clark's name is actually on the ballot, and that is her constituency, her own constituency, which is Vancouver Point Grey. It's the area in the city of Vancouver that includes the University of British Columbia and the west side. I think UBC's in it. Actually, I should check the election map on that. But in any event, it's the west side of the city. And the same with Adrian Dix, the leader of the New Democrats. His party name is on the ballot with a candidate in every constituency. But Adrian Dix is only, you only get to vote for him directly in his constituency, which is Vancouver Kingsway, so on the east side of the city, more of a working class riding, more of an immigrant riding than Clark's riding. So that's how it comes down. And, you know, the expectation is here, Marcy, that if Clark loses her constituency, is beaten there by a New Democrat who is a guy named David Eby. He's the former head of the BC Civil Liberties Association. Mm-hmm. She'll probably lose the government as well. That is a swing seat. If it changes hands, enough seats will change hands around British Columbia and the New Democrats will win a majority. If she manages to hang on and win her seat, she will probably wake up next Wednesday morning pinching herself that she's still Premier of British Columbia because the Liberals privately acknowledge that they are in one uphill fight.
We'll be talking about that for sure next week. What changes should this center-left party take control from the center-right party?
I think the big change that would be noticed and that would probably be of a lot of interest to people south of the border is the New Democrats are fierce opponents of any expansion of oil pipelines in British Columbia, of any expansion in oil tanker traffic out of the city of Vancouver or on our north coast. So there is a small refinery in Vancouver now. There is a relatively small amount of oil shipped through Vancouver. Dix and the New Democrats, and he made it very clear halfway through the campaign, Dix and the New Democrats are adamantly opposed to any increase in tanker traffic on the coast of British Columbia, any oil from Alberta coming through BC and being shipped out. So it may be that the first big defeat for Alberta's oil industry will not be a thumbs down on the Keystone Pipeline, and I recognize that the president may approve it. The first big thumbs down may come in British Columbia next Tuesday, which is if Dix and the New Democrats are elected, Alberta is going to have to find another place to send its oil because it's not coming through BC.
Just a little tangential question. We're talking like there's only two parties, as if your elections, like the U.S. elections, are between, you know, party number one and party number two. You have many other parties represented on
we
the ballot.
We do have other parties in British Columbia, although, you know, the province does tend to polarize, and as election day approaches, people tend to fall into one camp or the other. This election is a little unusual in that there is a chance that the Green Party of British Columbia, or the Green Party of Canada, because they operate at both levels, will elect its first member to the BC legislature. They may elect more than one. The Green Party is running internationally respected climatologist and Dr. Andrew Weaver. He's a professor at the University of Victoria. He was part of that United Nations team that produced the Nobel Prize-winning report on climate change. Mm. And Weaver is running. He's running for a seat in the BC legislature in a suburb of the provincial capital here. And he's got a good shot at winning. I think there's a feeling in that constituency, a feeling in the province, that the Greens, it would be good for if they had a voice in the legislature. One of our suburbs here elected the national leader of the Green Party, Elizabeth May, to Parliament in the last national election, and her constituency overlaps with the provincial one. So I would say I wouldn't be surprised if the Greens elect a member or two in the election next Tuesday. In two- or three-way races, it's always hard to predict, but we could have a Green presence in the legislature. We might have an independent or two. The Conservative Party has been relatively dormant in British Columbia for a long time, provincially, and they may elect a member or two as well. So we could have additional voices in our provincial legislature after the election, more voices than we've sometimes had in the past.
Well, I want to talk nationally for just a second. You mentioned environmental voices. You're talking about the Greens and the oil sands and Keystone Pipeline. Issue shows no sign of quieting down. And now your natural resources minister, Joe Oliver, is going toe-to-toe with perhaps the world's most illustrious spokesman for environmentalism, our former vice president, Al Gore.
Yeah, somebody with a great sense of mischief invited Al Gore to Canada. So this is now a three-part exchange. Gore tells the Globe and Mail newspaper in a story on Saturday, he denounces Canada's reliance on the oil sands. He says that resources are a curse to the country. They have damaged some extremely beautiful landscapes. The core issue, however, is adding to the reckless spewing of pollution into the Earth's atmosphere as if it is an open sewer. Mr. Gore hasn't lost his turn of phrase. Our natural resources minister came back and attacked Gore, and this was published in the papers yesterday. So Gore's comments are Saturday. Natural Resources Minister is out Monday. Gore's off the mark, wildly exaggerated, inaccurate, doesn't understand things up here, exaggerated, and so on. Gore came back last night. He gave a speech in Toronto. And he said there's no such thing as ethical oil. Canada's been kind of promoting itself as the ethical supplier of oil to the United States, because we're not Venezuela, and we're not the Middle East, and we're not, you know, Saudi Arabia, so we're the ethical partner. Gore has swatted all that aside and said there's no such thing as ethical oil. The country should be ashamed of itself. So I don't think our resources minister is going to win this argument. He's kind of hoping that somehow or other, the president will see his way clear to approve the Keystone Pipeline. He's also fighting with the Europeans, who were...
I was going to say, they're piling on as well.
It's not the... Well, and as I just told you, Alberta oil is not all that popular here in British Columbia. So there's a story recently that the province of Alberta is exploring a possible agreement with to the north. So the Northwest Territories, which are the northern part of Canada, perhaps getting an agreement with them to ship oil through there. There's been some talk about perhaps shipping it to Alaska and using their oil port. And, of course, I'm sure climate-aware people would point out that the only reason the province of Alberta could seriously think about sending tankers through the northern waters of Canada is because there's less ice up there now, thanks to global warming.
Oh, what a place to end. We're going to talk about the results of the BC elections with you next week. Thanks for being here today.
Great, Marcy.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Vaughn Palmer's political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun and a regular Wednesday guest on Weekday on KUOW.
That's the news from Canada. Next up, news from the world of film. The new movie, The Great Gatsby. How great is it? The thoughts of film critic Robert Horton in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community stewardship and culture, proud supporters of the Seattle Symphony. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at SnoqualmieTribe.com.
Well, it's 55 degrees in Seattle and it's still cloudy, but the forecast promises sun this afternoon and a high of 71. 1020, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Microsoft says it's reworking Windows 8 to make it more user-friendly. What's going on with that, and what does this mean for Microsoft? Business journalist Michael Parks joins us to talk about that in 20 minutes.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate.
Actually, what I really like is the new chocolate-covered popcorn in the lobbies. What about you?
Oh, don't even tell me about that. I didn't know that.
Only some lobbies have chocolate-covered popcorn. Well, it's been hyped. It's been decried. But you get to weigh in. Baz Luhrmann's 3D adaptation of the F. Scott Fitzgerald classic, The Great Gatsby, opens in area theaters this weekend. And I believe Robert Horton, film critic extraordinaire, that you weigh in on the decrier side of this.
Yes, I am a decrier. I am. What have we come to that we were talking about, a 3D adaptation of The Great Gatsby? But it's here. It's somewhat long delayed, but a movie that Baz Luhrmann, creator of Moulin Rouge and other extravaganzas, I think would be the word, has been tooling around with for a while now. And yeah, it hits theaters on Friday. And, I went into this thing with an open mind. It's like, okay, fine.
Did you?
Fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see what happens. Certainly, it sounded like Leonardo DiCaprio would be good casting for Gatsby, the mysterious millionaire. I thought that might be an interesting touch. And even the fact of that Luhrmann had gone and kind of mingled the musical styles a little bit, which was one of the...
We'll talk about that too. But mingling the styles, because he had a special musical consultant. Jay-Z was the musical consultant.
Yes. He's listed as an executive producer on the film, too. And I don't have... I actually don't have anything against that. I think, if it's... depending on what you're trying to do... try to do something. And so that was fine. But the movie turns out to be, on the one hand, very, very faithful to the novel in most ways. In fact, you can tell that it probably really means something to Baz Luhrmann and his collaborators, that they a lot of the prose is in there as it's spoken on the soundtrack and so on, and it follows the story quite closely. And yet it still doesn't work.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that. We have a clip, I believe, from Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby.
Mr. Gatsby, I'd like to know.
Exactly who are you, anyhow? Can't you see who this guy is? With his house, his parties, and his fancy clothes. We were born different from you.
It's in our blood. Nothing that you do or dream up can ever change that.
Wow. Well, first of all, I have to ask, is that what we're hearing, the music that goes along with those little clips of dialogue, that's from a trailer, is that indicative of what the soundtrack of this film is?
Well, I would say that in some ways it's more buried in the mix when you're actually watching the movie, so that you aren't sort of grabbed by the throat and told, you know, this is anachronistic and it's a real experiment, folks. It actually sort of folds into the overall vibe of the extravagance of Gatsby's life and so on.
Maybe we better take a step back and just talk briefly about the plot of the story for somebody who didn't have to read this in high school.
And it follows it closely, the point of view of a young man named Nick Carraway, who moves into a very modest house that happens to sit next to the very lavish house of a gentleman named Gatsby, a nouveau riche, a fellow who's arrived on the shores of Long Island and who gazes across the bay at the house that holds his former love, Daisy, played by Carey Mulligan in the film, who is now married to a very obnoxious but old money fellow named Tom Buchanan, who's played by Joel Edgerton in the film. And we see everything through Nick's point of view, and it's sort of a classic setup, and it works that way. The movie takes a misstep at the beginning because it begins with the narration that everybody knows from the first page of The Great Gatsby, but Nick is in a psychiatric hospital and he's recovering from excess, I guess, of the Roaring Twenties, because that's where we are. The book having come out in 1925, and so he narrates the book to a psychiatrist in the place, and he speaks in the voice of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Writing The Great Gatsby.
Is that how the book was?
No, that's an addition to
I didn't remember that.
Yeah, that's a sort of framing device that Lerman has come up with, and it doesn't feel right and it doesn't look right. It's almost like, how can we have this guy? What's the excuse for this guy narrating the whole thing? And so they came up with that. And after that, it does fold into a fairly, you know, beat-by-beat account of the movie, except that it looks like a Baz Luhrmann film. So there's a cut every 3 seconds or so, for no apparent reason other than just to keep things lively, I guess. And it's done up in really gaudy colors and camera movements and music.
And 3D.
And in this case, 3D, yes, which is the way I saw it. And that adds, I think, to the disembodied feeling that I got from the movie, the lack of rooting in anything, which I think would be there even without the 3D, I suspect, partly because Luhrmann seems so antsy that except for some of the later stages of the film, he won't let things settle down or let you get into the mood of Fitzgerald, which is pretty much crushed by Luhrmann's style.
Well, was this his project to begin with, or did somebody decide that he'd be the right person to interpret this?
I don't know what the origin was, but Luhrmann seems to be a guy who pursues things that mean something to him, like his big stage production of Aida. And I'm assuming it clearly means something to him, and he's expended a lot of energy and real care on it. And it exists in that digital universe, you know, that is long shots of mansions or the Valley of Ashes in the book, which is the area that rests between Long Island and mm-hmm. Manhattan, are rendered digitally, and so they have that unreal glitz to them. That maybe in some sense might work for an adaptation of the Fitzgerald world, but I don't think it works here.
Well, it brings up a bigger question, and that has to do with looking back in time at classics. And I have not yet seen this film, and you're not making me want to go and see it except for some sort of academic interest. But it made me think of the Marie Antoinette film that Sofia Coppola produced a few years back, which also got dinged a little bit because she also was sort of looking at the world through the 21st century eyes that she has. We have a clip from that movie.
You represent the future. All eyes will be on you.
She looks like a child. This is ridiculous.
This, madame, is Versailles.
So that's Kirsten Dunst as Marie Antoinette. It was a beautiful film to look at. I actually did see this one, but you heard the music. That was also mm-hmm. a bit like Baz Luhrmann consulting with Jay-Z. We're going to update a very, much older story in Marie Antoinette's case, but a story that's set back in time with music that is not an adherent of that same time period.
Yeah, I think I'm not at all against that idea. And in that case, Coppola was trying to maybe draw some parallels between a certain spirit here and a certain spirit that she might have seen going on in the subject of Marie Antoinette, just as I think Lerman perhaps sees in maybe a parallel between Gatsby and his kind of ferocious rise to be nouveau riche and not being accepted by anybody who was really, really rich, and maybe a hip-hop entrepreneur like Jay-Z who becomes part of today's nouveau riche, but maybe also struggles with the same issue or something like that. And that's fine if you want to make that part of the swirl, I suppose. It's certainly not the point of the movie. I don't think that's really the problem with it. It does raise this interesting point about mixing things. I mean, there was a time when there used to be sort of unwritten rules about period films, like you couldn't use a helicopter shot in a period movie.
Really?
Because they didn't have helicopters in the 18th century. So how could you do that?
Wow.
I think it was Tom Jones was one of the first one, Tony Richardson's film from the early 60s, using that kind of camera trickery. And it was like, is this a violation of, you know, this feeling that you're supposed to evoke?
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then why would you have lighting artists or use any kind of electronics? I mean, they didn't have film cameras
right,
in those days either.
Right, that's part of the contradiction of that kind of unwritten rule, which doesn't need to be there at all.
But that's a little bit different than having something that you as an artist inherently want to say about a period. I mean, The Great Gatsby, the reason people have to read it in school is because it has a very large moral theme to it. And I suppose the story of Marie Antoinette, it was also interesting to Sofia Coppola for that same kind of reason. These are stories that resonate beyond the individual level of the story. Mm-hmm. They resonate on a larger level. So when does that kind of storytelling work when you try to sort of mix it up?
Right. And I guess the other parallel would be the many Shakespeare adaptations that have been moved up to
absolutely.
The present day. Baz Luhrmann having executed one of those himself in his Romeo and Juliet, which had a kind of a rock and roll
did it work
thing. I thought that was an interesting movie. Yeah, yeah. The words didn't always survive too well, but that may have been some of the choices of actors. But it was an interesting shot at it.
Well, you brought up Shakespeare. Joss Whedon's Midsummer Night's Dream.
Much Ado About Nothing.
Much Ado About Nothing is opening the Seattle Film Festival in a couple weeks. And you saw it. Is that?
I haven't seen that.
You haven't seen it. I thought you had. That's another. It's the script. I mean, it's the words.
Yep. You're right.
But not in costume. In fact, as I understand it, it was shot in Whedon's home.
Yeah.
I've only read about it. I haven't seen it. So.
So it goes to what you're saying is that sort of kind of flexibility of something. Mm-hmm. If it resonates strongly enough, it may well survive these kinds of this kind of meddling around with it. I mean, you could do The Great Gatsby set in the 21st century, and you'd change the jobs, and you'd maybe change the location or whatever, and you might have an interesting thing there. And Lerman, who is obviously besotted with all sorts of all elements having to do with art design and production design and costumes.
That's true. It's always very lavish.
I mean, people are going to be coming out of this movie humming the pink suit that Leonardo DiCaprio wears because it's that kind of movie.
Well, let me ask you about the most recent version of film version of Anna Karenina with Keira Knightley, which wasn't really anachronistic, but it was a set within a set
yes.
kind of envisioning of it. So we go back to classics where you know, we have to read them in school because they theoretically teach us something. It's not just for the joy of it. Anna Karenina was a classic, but in that case, there was sort of a wink and a nod. We're setting it within
right.
a performative. It was set as if it was on a stage.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's lots of ways to revisit material. We want to update it. We know we don't live in that time period. you know, the Merchant Ivory beautiful costume dramas all were sort of languorous and slow and many very beautiful to my mind. But you could tweak them a little bit. So in the Baz Luhrmann case, is it just the excesses of this particular director's taste?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's what your motive is and how good you are if you're going to do that kind of experimenting around with it. And with Baz Luhrmann, I feel like in this case, he's missed something just because he's so drunk on the glamour of it. And he wants to replicate, you know, some of the images of Fitzgerald that have are so memorable as literary images. But Baz Luhrmann is by not at all a subtle filmmaker. That's the reason some of his movies are fun. Don't get me wrong. But when it comes to that, he can't help but kind of trample on the delicacy of, you know, what Fitzgerald wrought on the page. And that's kind of an eternal. So even if he had left out even if he had never heard of Jay-Z and did not include this kind of music, and even if he hadn't, even if he decided he was going to let a scene run for, or a single shot run for longer than 3 or 4 seconds, I think he still would have been too the hand would have been too heavy in this case.
Well, now you've got me thinking about a bigger question. So, listeners, you can weigh in on this at the Weekday Facebook page, or you can email us sometime this week, weekday@kuow.org. Do we need to revisit historical material at all, or should we revisit it at all? And if so, how do we make it resonate for a contemporary audience that is used to perhaps, I mean, do we do it via Twitter? Do we, you know, there are Twitter movies, Twitter plays, Twitter novels that are happening now?
I think a Twitter novel in 3D, I think that's what I'm waiting for.
Oh, goodness.
I think that's the way to reach the kids today, yes.
Well, last hour I was shouting out for somebody to make a musical composition out of the sound of the day, so maybe now somebody needs to make a 3D Twitter film that's based on a historical source material.
Yes.
Shakespeare.
Well, I mean, you and I are in 3D right now on the radio.
We are in somebody's mind.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the pleasure of radio.
Well, so speaking of history, you're going to be on the History Channel?
Yes. At the risk of my future reputation, I would like to tell you that I'm going to be on a show tomorrow night on the History Channel, Thursday night. Uh-huh. It's the first installment of a program called Monumental Mysteries. And I'm speaking in the show about an event that happened in 1947 when a local guy named Kenneth Arnold saw unidentified flying objects near Mount Rainier. And they decided they were going to do a segment of this, and they knew that I gave a talk about this subject and the movies that came out of it. And so I went down to Chehalis and taped this little thing in a museum down there, and it's going to be on tomorrow night.
Wow. So this has to do with your humanities business?
Humanities Washington talk that I gave last year, yeah, on 50 sci-fi films. We don't really get into the films because they wanted to talk about this guy's original sighting, which triggered the whole UFO craze, the flying saucer, little green men frenzy that broke out in the late 40s and early 50s.
You realize that you're stereotyping yourself as the sort of really grade B 1950s era, the E.T. precursor movie guy.
That could happen, yeah. I'll take that risk. I mean, I don't know. But I hope it's not too silly.
That's tomorrow night on the History Channel.
If it is, I won't acknowledge it next week.
And he'll write erudite things at thecropduster.com,
yes,
where we find your more academic leanings, your more intellectual leanings.
And for the quicker stuff, I am also on Twitter at Citizen Horton.
CitizenHorton.com. At the Everett Herald, writing straight up bad reviews in this case of Baz Luhrmann's new Great Gatsby film, and monthly Magic Lantern series at the Frye Art Museum. Always glad to have you take time out of this busy schedule.
Thank you, Marcy. I got a rush.
Robert Horton here on Weekday on KUOW.
Wow, he is everywhere. 1038, Microsoft's latest version of Windows, Windows 8, has not been popular with users. Now Microsoft will attempt to solve that problem. More in a minute. 54 degrees in Seattle under a gray sky. Forecast says expect sun this afternoon with a high of 71.
The KUOW Puget Sound Public Radio Board meets every other month. Meetings are open to the public. please visit our website at kuow.org for more information.
Explain aloud just what you're doing.
Radioactive is a journalism training program for youth ages 16 to 18.
We have some pretty great stories for you.
Summer applications are now open.
So tune in
if you dare.
Apply online by May 13th at kuow.org/radioactive.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to over 130 destinations worldwide. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:39. A majority of Americans now say they support legalizing marijuana. Of course, both Washington State and Colorado have legalized it for recreational purposes. But the fact that it's illegal as far as the federal government is concerned makes things complicated. Representative Earl Blumenauer from Oregon is co-author of H.R. 1523, the Respect State Marijuana Laws Act. We're going to talk with him in 30 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Microsoft says it's going to revamp Windows 8. You can look for something called Windows Blue later this year. Joining us with more on this and other business news, Michael Parks, editor emeritus of Marple's Northwest Business Letter and a regular guest. Nice to see you, Michael.
Good to be here, Marcy.
Well, I know you have talked about this with me, with Steve Scher, about the disappointing Windows 8 sales, the reception to this product. So what exactly has Microsoft decided it will do?
Well, it hasn't really specified. So it has told us that it will come out with a new iteration, that it will spell out in the next few weeks. First of all, a new name. Blue is the code name, but they'll give it a new name. They will tell us in the next few weeks whether we can get back our familiar desktop interface and that comfortable old start button down in the lower left corner. It's there in Windows 8, but you have to jump through hoops to get to it. Windows 8, of course, features the colorful tiles that are familiar to people who have smartphones. As I said, you can get to it, but you have to jump back and forth. And Windows 8, notwithstanding the fact that Microsoft said yesterday it has sold 100 million licenses, it has been a big disappointment.
Well, it's interesting on several levels. One is that obviously Microsoft felt compelled to compete with iPhone and the sort of Android touchscreen products.
Yes.
And so
the move to mobile, the mobile internet tsunami.
And yet, I heard earlier on NPR, their tech correspondent was saying that it's a little bit of a catch-22 because as you try to move ahead, you've got, you know, hundreds of millions of users of something that has nothing, no touchscreen, no tile, nothing to it that you may be leaving behind in the dust.
Exactly. The most pertinent comment in that line that I saw was from Jason Ponton, the editor of the MIT Technology Review. He put it this way. He said, first of all, Windows is a civilizational tool.
Civilization.
There are more than a billion users of Windows around the globe. But he said, set one of those users in front of a Windows 8 computer, and for the first time, he or she will literally recognize nothing that he or she is familiar with. So Tammy Reller, who is a co-head of the Windows division, conceded in interviews with the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, the New York Times, that there is a learning curve and that Microsoft needs to speed up the ability of people to learn. Part of the problem is bridging the era from PCs without touchscreens to mobile telephones and tablets. Another problem is that it's designed for touchscreens, but most PCs that are in the retail channel today do not have touchscreens. Your phone has one. Your tablet has one. But when you want to get to work on Excel or Word or PowerPoint, even if you're using a laptop, most likely you will be using a keyboard and a mouse rather than a touchscreen.
Well, so I know we've talked a lot in the past about Microsoft gambling on its telephone, which really didn't sell very well. Now Windows 8, which despite 100 million in sales, is nothing compared to billions sold worldwide of earlier things. So what is this? Does this hurt them financially?
First of all, Microsoft remains a great company, and it has great sources of revenue outside of Windows. Office is the cash cow, although there's a twist there. Microsoft has not made Office available to mobile devices, to tablets. By and large, it's not made it available to tablets and smartphones. It's kept it tied to Windows. Meanwhile, Google and others have made alternatives available. So there's a question there. Microsoft has great sources of revenue. It's still generating lots and lots of cash. It's able to pay a decent dividend to its shareholders. The concern is that the move to mobile has kind of passed it by, that it has not been able to keep up to speed with Apple, Google, Samsung, the other people who have made such strides in mobile.
This announcement about Windows 8, though, was good for Microsoft stock value?
It's down a little bit today, but smart money has been betting that Microsoft is going to make a comeback. Its stock has been range-bound roughly between 22 and 30 for a decade or more, and it has popped up above 30.
I want to jump ahead. Microsoft is heading to the bond market. I wanted you to explain what is going on. You just said it has great sources of cash, so why would it need to go to the bond market for loans?
It's interesting. Microsoft, Apple, and other technology companies have huge amounts of cash sitting on their balance sheet, but much of the money is sitting offshore because tax rates are lower offshore. And if these companies repatriated their cash, they would have to pay the American corporate tax rate, which at the max is 35%. So it turns out it's cheaper for them, partly because Ben Bernanke is keeping us in an era of financial repression, keeping interest rates low. So these companies find it more effective and cheaper to borrow at extremely low interest rates to return cash to shareholders in the form of either dividends or stock buybacks. What discourages me about this is that because they're not paying American taxes on the money that's sitting offshore, it means that the burden of government falls to the rest of us who don't have the success or the luck to have large amounts of cash offshore. It's rational economically. It doesn't make sense to bring the money back, especially when interest is deductible as a corporate expense. We need to remember that dividends have to be paid out of after-tax income, whereas you can deduct the interest on debt. So it makes sense economically, but from a tax policy and a public policy perspective, it's somewhat troubling.
We're talking with Michael Parks about business, as we do regularly on this program. And Boeing, it's kind of, where are we with that? They're going to send some engineering work to South Carolina. Bad news. There might be balanced with some good news.
Yes. This is engineering work that had been done by a Boeing contractor. It's engineering work on the next iteration of the 737 called the MAX, which will have new engines. The plane will be produced at Renton, but the engineering work goes to Charleston, South Carolina, where Boeing set up a production line for the 787.
How much engineering work is already located in South Carolina? I thought the bulk of it had stayed in the Puget Sound.
Oh, it has, and I think actually the 737 MAX announcement is kind of the first, the introduction of engineering to the South Carolina complex.
I know that your colleague John Talton of the Seattle Times thinks that the door has now been opened and the big rush to South Carolina, maybe not the big rush, but the seepage to South Carolina will continue to get stronger.
Absolutely. There is an aerospace analyst in the Seattle area, Scott Hamilton, with Liam and company. I was reading his blog yesterday. Hamilton thinks Everett is good. There's a new iteration of the 777, the big twin coming. And he says that will keep Everett in good shape as the 747 phases out. But Hamilton actually says that Renton will eventually close, that all of the production will be taken out of there, and Renton, the property will go over to something like the Renton Landing or the...
The special sort of mall. That,
real estate development apartments and that sort of thing. Scott Hamilton at Liam & Company. It's worth checking out his blog.
Well, that would mean the loss of quite a few jobs.
There are, I believe, something like 10,000 or 11,000 people working at Renton, and Boeing currently is increasing production there up to, I think, 42 or 44 planes a month by the middle of next year.
What kind of commitment has the company made to its Everett facility?
It has not made a commitment as to where the new version of the 777 will be assembled. It's pretty clear that if we get those jobs, it will be because we are competitive, both in terms of well-trained people and good infrastructure that makes it possible for Boeing to operate profitably.
Well, that's sort of the 300-pound gorilla or the 800-pound gorilla for Boeing. Tacoma got a little good news this week. Russell Investments had vacated its home city for Seattle a few years ago, leaving a big hole.
There was that was a big hole in office space. The former Russell headquarters and a nearby building left with a lot of vacancy. State Farm has a telephone center in DuPont, call center, but it has taken up this Russell space in downtown Tacoma, made a commitment, I believe, for about 300,000 square feet of office space that in time could accommodate 1,000 employees, and has made clear these are new jobs. It isn't going to diminish that DuPont Center, at least to start.
Well, in time, meaning 10 years or 10 weeks?
You know, I'm not sure they have specified. I believe the reporting said about 300 people will be hired this summer, and then they will go from there, but I'm not sure the time window. I'm not sure the time window has been specified.
300 new jobs.
300 new jobs, in addition to the 1,000 in the call center at DuPont.
Well, and I imagine 300,000 square feet rented out as opposed to vacant in the heart of a city is good news.
It's got to cheer up people in Tacoma who were, you know, discouraged by that Russell move to Seattle.
Well, while we're talking about employment, I just want to end on a New York Times report by David Leonhardt about the unemployment rate among young people, and we're talking not teenagers, but sort of post-collegiate age, 25 to 34. We hear a lot about Spain and Greece, but things aren't so great here.
Yeah, they're not so great. It's one of kind of the big trend stories that caught my eye. A report on Sunday said that the United States has gone from the lowest rate of people not in work in the age group 25 to 34 to the highest rate. We now have a higher rate of people in that cohort without jobs, either because they're in education or because they're looking for work and can't find it. So we now have a higher rate than Germany, Japan, Great Britain.
It's 27%, according to this article. Is that because we're not creating new jobs?
It is.
We hear those unemployment figures or employment figures since the Obama administration is trying to put a happier spin on it.
Sure.
100-some thousand people found new jobs, almost all, in the private sector. I don't think there are any new jobs in the public sector. And that's not figuring in the people who are there's a word for the people who aren't seeking any
discouraged.
More. Discouraged
workers. Well, the David Leonhardt, who wrote the article, said this reflects two trends, basically. One, the Great Recession was much harder on young people than older people. And part of that is because with their retirement savings diminished during the Great Recession, older people aren't moving out of the way. They're not vacating. But the other is that this recovery which I call the great disappointment, the economy has recovered without creating as many jobs as a normal recovery would create.
Well, you call it a great disappointment. The official thing is the jobless recovery.
Jobless recovery is the same.
I heard recently Britain had slumped back into recession. When you look at numbers like this and the sort of tepid upsurge in jobs, I guess that's the best that you can call it. Is there a danger at this point of the U.S. slipping back into recession?
I don't think so. You know, we have GDP growing at a nominal rate of about 4%, a real rate in excess of 2%. Actually, we find, notwithstanding the high unemployment rate, consumers are spending. The automobile industry is prospering. The housing market is doing well. We had headlines this last week that housing prices are up.
Right.
What you can say about the American economy is that with its relatively low growth rate and relatively low growth in employment, it's the best house in a bad neighborhood. we're not doing as well as we should be doing. We're not doing as well as we have been in past recoveries. But compared with our peers in the rich world, Germany, France, Japan, the UK, we're doing relatively well.
You know, I can't help to go back to the beginning of this conversation. When you hear news about Microsoft and Boeing and, you know, changes in their at their corporate headquarters, whether they're going to keep jobs in this area, whether a redevelopment of a product that was not successful in Microsoft's case means revamping. I know that they did have a round of layoffs at Microsoft. It just seems that what we do have, and we're doing pretty well as far as regional sectors of the country, that it is not we're not at a stable footing.
The uncertainty level has been high for some time, and it remains relatively high going forward. I don't see that changing. We're dealing with a lot of uncertainty. The uncertainties grow partly out of gridlock in Washington, D.C. We don't know what taxes are going to be. We've embarked on this great experiment in healthcare, which is a seventh or a sixth of the economy that comes into full effect next year. We don't know what the effects are going to be there. So you're right when you put your finger on this idea that the ground doesn't really feel very steady under our feet.
Well, I'm assuming that that's one of the reasons that new jobs aren't being created. But when you tell me that it's because corporations are keeping all their money offshore to pay out dividends instead of developing new jobs, you know.
It is, in a sense, it's an outrage. And I find it outrageous. But as I say, it makes sense economically. The way to fix it, there's an op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal that spells out the ways to fix it. One way to fix it is to reform the tax system, to lower that high corporate rate, which no corporations pay, so it's more competitive with other countries, and to take away the advantage that accrues to companies that borrow as opposed to companies that pay out dividends after tax.
Michael Parks is editor emeritus of Marple's Northwest Business Letter. He writes about the Northwest economy at his site, michaeljparks.com. And he's a regular guest. Every few weeks, we welcome you back here.
And a member of KUOW and a great fan of public radio.
Well, thank you. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellette is the man at the helm. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, Robert, believe it or not, Ripley joins us. We're also going to be talking about the nature of genius. Bernard, we toss around that word a lot, you know, oh, you're a genius at pie baking. You're a genius
yeah.
at sewing. And, you know, who is really a genius? What makes them genius? And is that word lost all its meaning because we throw it around so much?
Good question.
That's tomorrow. You can tune in to find out.
All right. It's 10:58, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Charges of political cronyism were flying late last night at a meeting in Clark County. Some folks are upset about the hiring of State Senator Don Benton as the Clark County's new Director of Environmental Services. We'll have more on that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Nature Consortium, working to restore the West Duwamish Greenbelt, providing arts programming over 300 days a year through a youth art program and the Arts in Nature Festival on August 10th and 11th. More information online at naturec.org.
Fifty-four degrees in Seattle, still pretty cloudy. Forecast says expect sun this afternoon with a high of 71. Overnight, we're going to drop down to 53, partly cloudy. Tomorrow, Thursday, a lot like today with clouds in the morning and then sun in the afternoon. Tomorrow, we're expecting to get up to 75.
Support for KUOW comes from HopeLink, whose End Summer Hunger project provides vital nutritional needs for youths during summer vacation when school programs are not available. Information about school or individual involvement in End Summer Hunger is on the web at hope-link.org.
How much do you care about a politician's private life? Things like affairs and sex scandals. Do these things make a difference to you when it comes time to vote? Why or why not? We're going to take that up today at noon, and we want to know what you think right now. Give us a call, 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. Politicians' private lives, do they matter? That's today during the noon hour.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.